Sustaining Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Mari Riesberg. Over the past several years, I've combined my degrees in acting and somatic psychology to share my sustaining creativity techniques with performers. And now I've decided to share it with a bigger audience that includes you. I believe we are all creative, and this podcast is all about that. I'll be interviewing people from all backgrounds, ages, and creativity experiences to share just how creative we all are. Today, I'll be chatting with Andy Fry, sports writer and author of 90 Days in the 90s. Please enjoy Andy Fry. Welcome to the Sustaining Creativity Podcast. Today, I'm here with Andy Fry, sports writer and author of 90 Days in the 90s. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ari.
I'm super excited to chat with you about being a sports writer, an author, how creativity shows up in your life. But before we get there, if you wouldn't mind letting our listeners know a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I write currently for Forbes as a contributor on sports and sports business. I've been lucky. I've been able to interview all kinds of great people. I typically do interview-based articles. And I've interviewed athletes you never heard of and athletes that you have heard of, like Lindsey Vonn and Tom Brady and Shaq and Billie Jean King. And it really just evolved from when I started my writing, I think, you know, I always thought it was a hobby that I wanted to do something with, like going back, you know, 10, 12 years ago. I just started small and started writing about extreme sports and sort of whatever I could get published, and then just built on that. But yeah, I also published a book almost a year ago called 90 Days in the 90s, a rock and roll time travel story. It's a fiction book. It's a novel. It's about someone who's roughly my age who time travels back to the 1990s and, you know, I guess in keeping with the theme of time travel and the movies we grew up with, like Back to the Future and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, you know, she has some personal reasons to go back and some things that she wants to, problems that she wants to solve. But when Darby is back in the 1990s, she gets caught up in having fun in the 90s and the music scene and the pop culture scene and kind of doesn't really deal with her issues. And, you know, that's sort of a subsequent problem in the novel that she has to deal with. So, yeah, it's very music heavy. It takes place in Chicago. It's sort of a tribute to Chicago and Chicago's music scene, but also the 1990s and all the explosion of creativity and new subgenres of music like grunge and punk and trip hop and things that came to fruition in the 90s. So yeah, 90 Days in the 90s is, you know, it took me 5 years to write. A lot of, I think, what I put into it as writing a book that is a situation where a narrator tells a story about someone else. I got a lot out of my interviewing of athletes and other different people, just to kind of interviewing, I guess the creative side of it is that the onus on you is to retell someone's story in a way that is, you know, kind of digestible and direct, and you highlight someone and elaborate on the things that they've done. And that really helped me out, I think, writing the novel down the road when I got to figuring out what exactly I was doing, that sure. Really helped. Yeah. So
nice. Well, I look forward to finishing it. I have not finished it yet, but I have started it. So, and being in high school in the 90s, and the Pacific Northwest grunge music experience, I'm excited to get to those pieces in it. Mm-hmm. So, well, I want to just jump right in and ask you, what does it mean to you to be creative?
I think it's, you know, for different people, it means different things. I suppose in the most, naked, abject form, we think of someone, you know, with a canvas making something elaborate with paints and getting inspiration from somewhere. I think I'm not a very, like, I was never a good student. I'm not a very analytical person, but I think I was probably always good at listening. So when I started writing just kind of as a hobby in high school and maybe even earlier than that, actually. I could talk about my first article in the school newspaper in fourth grade. I think it was just, I've always been interested in other people's stories and kind of why people do the things that they do, either recreationally or professionally, whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's kind of like, I guess in human history, there's this storytelling thread that happens, and sometimes we really emphasize it and sometimes we ignore it. And I think for me, creativity has just been sort of taking a snapshot of what's going on out there and, you know, using language to elaborate on, make it interesting to somebody. I think I could talk to people about sports. People who don't follow sports, I can tell you an interesting story about sports. You know, whether it's something that I've witnessed as a sports fan or as an interviewer. I mean, I think there's different ways to tell a story and really kind of recount people's existence when you're communicating with a person. And I think that that's a form of creativity that has grabbed me and that I'm interested in sharing.
Nice. I mean, I love the interview piece and the telling stories piece, because I appreciate that and really love doing that too on a podcast, but also as a therapist listening to other people's stories. So different versions of people's stories and essentially interviewing them about their life. But yeah. I'm so curious, what is it about like that interview experience when you're listening to someone's story and that moment of where you think this, I can turn this into something, or be something special?
Yeah, I just try to always be authentic with people and be direct. I was in sales for, you know, I don't know, more than 10 years. And I sold everything from currencies to insurance to investments. And I did a lot of handholding and technology when I was, you know, I got into technology in the late 90s, and I wasn't like a supercomputer programmer, but I did kind of the relationship piece of it. So I had to like, just as a little anecdote thing, like a lot of my life was kind of solving problems that are easily solvable, but also helping, kind of handholding and just making relatable things, complex things relatable to people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess it's just a matter of, you know, connecting with somebody. And so I studied and did improv comedy for a long time, which is a very Chicago thing to do.
Yeah.
If you take a class, you know, if you take classes in improv, the first thing that they try to tell you to do is, I guess to quote one of my first teachers, Susan Messing, who, you know, she uses F-bombs a lot. She said, you know, relax your crack. It's, stop trying to think of things to say, just interact in the moment with the person that's on stage with you. And you do, it's kind of a hard thing. Like you think that if you're taking a comedy class, you got to come with a punchline, but it's really not about that. So I think that helped. A lot of times I'm interviewing people, and so the reason I brought up improv comedy is that they said if you just sort of interact with somebody on stage, or two people, or however many people in the scene, you get what are called gifts. So if you are interviewing somebody and you're just relating to them as a normal person, you know, hopefully you're not, you know, getting caught up in being nervous or whatever, you get gifts. So I can give you a couple examples, but when I got to interview Tom Brady about a year and a half ago, I knew it was going to be on audio Zoom. I thought he probably was going to come up visually on screen. So he came up with screen. He's super polite, by the way, and I'm not by any means a Patriots fan or a Buccaneers fan where he went after that. And yeah, so I said, can you see me? And he said, no, this is the beginning of the interview. I'm recording it. No, I can hear you though. And I said, okay, well, so good. So you can't see me wear my Nick Foles Eagles jersey, and you can't see the Philadelphia Eagles wallpaper behind me, which, you know, you're looking at me right now, that I was joking about that. And yeah, I kind of rubbed it in his face politely that he lost the Super Bowl with the Eagles. Now, he won a lot of Super Bowls. He won 7 of them. So, I mean, he only lost, I think, 3, maybe 4. I think he lost twice to the Giants, once to the Eagles. I haven't kept count of everything he's done. But, you know, he was cool enough to roll with it, and we joked around a little bit. And then when we got into the main reason I was interviewing him was he had launched the Brady brand. So, you know, what I did was I said, you know, I know you won a bunch of Super Bowls, you're great at football, you're starting this brand, but, you know, I know that you probably don't know a lot about textiles, and you probably know a bit about fashion, but not design. Like, tell me about being coachable or having to listen to people who are experts in these things that you're not experts in. So, I mean, I think he warmed up to that. Maybe he was prepared for those questions. I don't know, but yeah, he tells you little anecdotes and talks about working with other people. And before you know it, you're talking to what seems like a normal person, not just, a six-time Super Bowl. I think a six-time. Maybe he won the seventh. Maybe it was after the seventh Super Bowl. I can't remember now. But a seven-time Super Bowl winner. But you're talking to a person who's just starting a business and, you know, trying to work business environment with people who know things more than he does. So, you know, that's one way. And then other times, like, you ask questions. I get to interview when I was doing a stint with ESPN, I had this kind of like, I guess, theme going on of interviewing aging rock stars about their sports hankering. So I got to interview Billy from Smashing Pumpkins when he started his wrestling league and talked about his ongoing career. I got to interview Noel Gallagher from Oasis, and I asked him about sports because I know he's a big soccer fan. I know football, you know, English football. I had asked him, I said something like, he keeps, if you look at any of Noel Gallagher's, his independent work, you know, after he left Oasis, all the music videos have like a sports thing going on, like a sports reference or something. There's one video where it's a couple and they're boxers and the woman is beating the crap out of the guy and he's the referee in the ring. And I asked him about that. And I asked him about American sports. I said, do you follow any American sports? You know, thinking he'd say no, or what are you talking about? And he told me he didn't get baseball, basketball, or hockey, but he really loved the NFL, watching American football. Okay. And I never heard that before. And I wasn't trying to put him on the spot, but I was, you know, I knew that he was a sports fan in some measure. So I wanted to find out, you know, mm-hmm. what do you think? And he elaborated. And I think with interviewing, you can, if you ask what we call open-ended questions and then just shut up and let people talk, like they'll tell you things about themselves or neat things that you didn't know that you were prying for. And it's like jujitsu. It's, you know, you don't create a lot of resistance. You get, you know, they just sort of come at you with probably, if you're writing a story about them, the things that you want to know about.
Yeah. I mean, I love hearing you say you did improv theater and comedy and how present you have to be to do that. And it sounds like that really translates into how you interview someone, really paying attention to the being present with them and what they're sharing mm-hmm. with you. And well, go ahead.
I was going to say it's more about the cool part of improv is that, yeah, you're present, but it forces you to relax, not attend to yourself to be super, you know, present. It's more like you learn to be yourself. Mm-hmm. And then so I carried that over to interviewing. Maybe it's just I've done a lot of interviews. I'm comfortable with it. But when you're yourself or you're just having a conversation with another human being, like you would yeah. your friend in the coffee shop, then the tension, you know, sort of what we call in sales, the task tension is knocked down a whole bunch. And then it opens up all kinds of things. Like you joke around with people. I'll give you another example. Like I've interviewed Billie Jean King twice. Mm-hmm. I think I'm pretty talkative. She's more talkative than I am. And both times I've interviewed her, her comms people come on and they say, Billie Jean, she's got to go soon. And then she'll say like, no, we're having a conversation here. So, which is kind of funny that they wanted to get her off and I was fine with letting her go. And she wanted to talk about what we were talking about, which is, you know, she's at sports and business and social mm-hmm. justice with her. And then we were talking about, I talked to Billie Jean King the last match that Serena played at the US Open, but it was in the afternoon. I think it was a Friday, it was before that Friday mm-hmm. night. So she was going on and on about how great Serena was as a person and all this stuff. And tell me little stories about her and little things that she's experienced just being around, you know, being a local around the tennis venues. So if you just kind of lighten up and let people be people and not try to be, you know, all cute and clever and get a zinger, then I think things happen better. Mm-hmm. So it's really about relaxing, not about trying to be present like you are, you're winning a sword fight. You're not in a sword fight. You're in a conversation and it should be like that, I think.
Fair. Makes sense. Yeah. You mentioned writing your first newspaper article in fourth grade.
Yeah.
What's your earliest memory of being creative?
I used to do little things in second grade. I mean, this sounds silly when I say it, but like, I remember one time I wanted to like open a Chinese restaurant in my bedroom. So I like, you know, because I love Chinese food. So I made a menu and, you know, tried to assimilate, I guess, as much as a second grader could, some different entrees and things. And it's not like I had food stored in my room, but I like set up a little table. And I just remember doing like things like that. It's weird that when we're kids, we want to be adults. We want to be grownups. I think it has primarily to do with freedom and authority. Mm-hmm. When we're, you know, in our 30s, 40s, 50s, we long for some of the freedom of youth, or at least as we perceive it. That's kind of how and why I wrote this novel, 90s and the 90s, and a time travel novel of this woman who's about 50 or so, maybe late 40s, going back to her mid 20s to kind of sort things out, but really to have fun or to discover if she could have fun again. Mm-hmm. So I think I just had creativity through fun play. And then the writing kind of came a little bit later. In fourth grade, I wrote an article called Chess Champs for the Blair Mill Beagle. And I think it was one of those winters where it snowed every day, and it snowed so much we couldn't even go outside for recess. So we were locked in. Someone brought a chessboard or got out the chessboard, and all of a sudden, before I knew it, the whole class was playing. It was a big friggin' deal. And I guess when we were asked if we wanted to contribute to the student newspaper, the first one ever, I was enough obsessed with chess that I wanted to recount what was going on. And, you know, as you would guess, a fourth grader's article in the student newspaper, I think it was like 150 words, but something stuck with me along the way. And yeah, that was my first sports article, I guess you could say.
I love it. On chess. That's great. Now, when you think about the people that you've interviewed or the other people in your life that you exchange life with, what are some of the challenges that they come up against in terms of creativity?
I don't know. I don't know that I really believe in writer's block. I mean, I guess everybody's different. Either you're writing or you're not, and you are, it's easy as a writer. I can't really speak to about like being a sculptor, a painter, or, you know, a screenwriter necessarily. But as a writer who's just kind of a general writer, I've written, you know, I write sports articles, I write about fiction. I'm essentially a freelancer, so I don't have like deadlines necessarily. You got to want to do it every day. And there's times where you want to do it less. I mean, right now I've got another book idea. I spent 5 years writing 90 Days in the 90s. It was great. I keep telling people that what fueled it was that I had created this cool place in the past with these cool people I wanted to hang out with. So, you know, 4 to 5 days a week, most often in most weeks, 4 days a week, I was writing for 2 to 3 hours. I was just sitting down at my desk and going back and hanging out with those people, whether it was editing a chapter to kind of bring down the word count or make it slicker or turn up some emotions in the chapter. So there was a lot of that. And then I'm kind of drawing, almost alluding your question here, but I think you just got to make it a practice. There are times when you don't want to write. So I'm right now, I guess I'm kind of in a stint where I don't want to write quite as much, or I'm not really like, oh, I have that idea about this next book I'm going to do. I need to write that down. You get to that point, but you got to kind of do it every day. And so it's like, if you're running the marathon, and I'm never going to run a marathon because I hate running, but if you're running the marathon, you can't just decide to go run the marathon. You know, I guess as a marathon runner, you pretty much need to spend all day Sunday running 10 to 12 miles, which to some people I know 12 miles is like, that's fun and they're done in the morning. To me, that would be hell, but you gotta run every couple of days and keep your feet and your legs agile and, you know, kind of keep a practice of it. I think that people who are writers, you have to do it. What I don't like hearing from people is I want to be a writer either. And I'm not saying that when I say that you're a writer or you're not, I'm not saying it in an elitist way. It's like, well, you're a real writer or not. Like, you gotta, it doesn't matter if you have had anything published or not, you gotta be motivated enough, or I think like your subjects enough to jump on your blog every couple of days, or to write something down, or you have a, you know, you gotta make a practice of it. Just like if you're a skateboarder, you don't decide once a month that you really psyched about skateboarding. Like, you probably like it or love it enough that you're gonna do it every day or every couple of days at least. So I like in writing to like being a gamer. Like, I don't think there's anybody who started playing video games because, you know, they saw that Dan TDM or Big Cheese are making millions of dollars. And I want to do that. It's not like I want to be a lawyer or doctor to make a lot of money. It's because they love video games and they probably love it too much and would spend all day doing it. And then some of them get good enough and dedicated enough to do the esports thing or become a gamer celebrity, I guess. But it really all starts with the love of being a video gamer. I think writing's got to be the same way. You know, I mean, I guess there's people who, you know, as a sports writer, it was kind of a little bit of a jump to write a novel, but I think everybody has an idea for a book, whether you're writer or not. We all have cool ideas that we think could be a movie. It's taking the onus of taking that to the next level and actually doing something with it. So creativity has to be done. Creativity has to go hand in hand with some motivation, whether it's goal-oriented motivation or just you love the subject enough that you want to write about it because it's cool.
Yeah, it sounds like being consistent is also alive in that as well.
Yeah, there comes a sense of urgency when you're writing, I think. I mean, maybe not all writers are like this. I just hate the idea of, I'm going to write a novel and I'm going to wait for the inspiration to find me. And you could wait a decade for that, or maybe it's just you're not really motivated. You're making an excuse. I'm probably a lot more type A than most writers are. I'm not particularly empathetic to people who put things off. If you're a writer, I just think you gotta do something. You gotta do a little something. And so E.L. Doctorow, I think, wrote his first novel when he's 47, or published his first novel when he's 47. I remember a quote from him was something along the lines of, it's like driving in the dark. You only got your headlights in front of you. You can only kind of see what's in front of you, and you keep going. You don't know exactly where the road's going to turn or, you know, swoop. And you do make discoveries, and you do get gifts if you keep doing it. You think, oh, I could go an example about, I don't want to talk too long, but I could go in examples about characters. And you, when you develop a character, you have personality tics, and then you might find out why your character hates the holidays. You got a story behind it. Now you got some backstory or something like that. So you got to keep it going. And then it does seem trying at first, but good things happen when you just move along.
Yeah. It strikes me too that there's a lot of imagination at play, kind of creating characters and their backstory and all of that. Were you a kid who had a really active imagination? Were you daydreaming? Like, where does that come from for you?
Yeah, I was, that's why I was a bad student. I was too busy looking out the window. One of my favorite quotes, I love English rock. And I know some people think that the band Oasis, they think that they're just Beatles ripoffs, or they only know their radio hits. They're actually, like, if you listen to their first album, they're pretty entrenched and creative as far as like English rock goes. Mm-hmm. And I remember Liam Gallagher was asked one time about, like, how'd you become like this, you know, rock star from just being a kid who didn't care about music? And he's like, I spent a lot of time looking out the window, you know, like, and I think he said, he looks at the camera and goes, you kids out there, if you want to become something big, you know, spend a lot of time daydreaming, looking out the window. So I don't know. There's something to that. I think there's different ways that people are creative. I mean, there are some people, like, I think Stephen King supposedly read like 10,000 books before he was 14. I'm not even in the ballpark of that. I don't know if I've ever even read, you know, 100, 200 books. I'm not going to start now at age 51. Mm-hmm. But there's different ways that we go about our business. And I think it's just more being motivated about, you know, playing with ideas and telling stories. And yeah, everybody's different.
Yeah. How would you encourage others to find that creativity in their life?
I think give yourself some credit. I mean, if you're, you know, a grown up and you have a day job and you think, well, I guess that's a great idea, but I'm not a writer. Well, you know, Jo Rowling, I'm not going to get into her politics and all the stupid things that she said online about trans issue, because I think she's a great writer. She should stick to being a great writer. But at one point she was an unemployed single mother sitting on a park bench, kind of grieving about her situation, how much things sucked. And she had these great ideas that, as you know, she wrote a manuscript, and I can't remember what the number is. It's been made out to sound like she got turned down by 100 different publishing houses. I don't know if it's been that much, but it was enough that it was, you know, it's not like she wrote this manuscript and the first people who looked at it saw, this is great, this is going to sell a million copies. It took some time and effort, and she believed in this little world that she created about this kid with glasses and a, you know, who is a warlock and a, you know, amongst a group of good little witch and warlock study, you know, like students of that craft. So, yeah, I mean, look at examples. Not everybody, I mean, most writers aren't Stephen King. They aren't disciplined from day one.
Right.
You know, there's all kinds of different examples of creative people that picked up things late. I mean, I can give you other examples if you want, but I think it's just give yourself some credit. Got an idea, play with it. See how motivated you are. Kick yourself in the ass a little bit to kind of see your idea through, to, you know, let yourself be creative with it. And then good things can happen. And again, not everybody's a writer. Not everybody's going to write a novel, but, you know, you got to give yourself some credit and for your idea being creative, and then see what you can do with it.
Nice. Great reminders and some permission to, like, if you have the idea, follow the idea. Don't just discount it.
Yeah, you said it. I'm married to a therapist. You sounded like a therapist right there. So give yourself permission to try and fail with your idea. Don't think that it's stupid just because you're not a writer, or who's going to read about. I mean, Neil Gaiman writes about dragons. You talk to humans, and he sold a ton of books. I'm never going to write about a dragon, I don't think. I mean, that's a whole different direction that I can't even get my head around. It's just, I think in terms of like improv comedy, like quirky scenes and, just kind of just normal people interacting in funny ways and unlikely things come out of those everyday interactions. That's sort of my read on the world. So, but I mean, if you want to write about dragons or, I don't know, beer cans that talk to each other, whatever, give it a shot.
Why not? Who are your favorite characters that have ever come out of your writing?
Well, I mean, I've only written one novel. So Darby is, she's a record store owner. She's, I guess, when I originally had the idea for 90 Days in the 90s, I will say I thought heavily in terms of themes. So to give you some example, and it's not like it's not an allegory or anything like, Paradise Lost, but she's a Gen Xer and she kind of did the sellout career thing. And the novel starts with her back in Chicago. She takes over her uncle's record store, her favorite uncle who she really related to musically, who died and left this record store. So she feels bad about that. She didn't really keep in touch with them that well. And also her career in New York, trying to be a Wall Street hotshot, failed. Mm-hmm. And she broke up with her fiance. So it's very Gen X-y and very much like, they say of us, of my generation, we're always looking for something. I suppose that's still true, even though we're in our 50s now. But I also got to play with other themes that sort of informed characters. So yeah, Darby's kind of the seeker. She's looking for something. She's not really dealing with her stuff, so to speak. And she goes back in the 1990s and still isn't dealing with her issues. And she gets confronted with that. But, but my best friend is a poetry writer and a short story writer, and he had some success publishing before I did. He was married to a woman who I thought was fun to hang out with, but was difficult to be in a relationship with. We often joke that his first wife was like being married to a Woody Allen movie, not just Woody Allen, but a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah.
And then that subsided. He started writing again. So, he informs one of my characters, it's Darby's best friend, who she lost touch with, but kind of when she goes back to the 90s, realigns with her friend Spiro, who's kind of like, at the time in the 90s, he's a grad student in literature. He's kind of a pseudo-socialist who has an opinion about everything. And, it's he spends most of his time studying and reading books and drinking coffee, bottomless cup of coffee in a cafe all day. Has his own hangups and quirks. And, the two of them go along pretty well and kind of are yin-yang and push each other's buttons. And, I mean, there's other characters in the book, too. But I had fun with the two of them, not just because they're sort of, I guess, if not informed, like I'm not Darby, but I sort of can relate to a lot of the things that she is and experiences. But that also made me want to hang out with the characters that I wrote about and help see me through finishing the book. So I'd rather talk more about other people's characters, because I think we're all informed and influenced by fiction and movies that we see. And I tend to think my generation is more influenced by movies and TV than the books that we were forced to read in high school and middle school. So that's kind of a different lead into creativity, but I think it's one that's, actually has something to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I've never really thought about the being influenced by movies and television versus books or games or, where we get our influences from. So I like that.
I can give you an example. So in the 90s, not just music changed, but movies changed a bit. So three of my favorite movies from the 90s, I'll give you three. There's three movies that all take place in the span of one day. There's Pulp Fiction, there's Dazed and Confused, and there's Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And in each of the movies, if you're not, if my parents watched it, they would say, these movies don't have a plot. There's really nothing going on. And that's true to an extent, but there's also a lot going on. There's the look and feel is that you're hanging out with these characters and doing the little things that they're doing that we do in normal life.
Yeah.
And that is sort of how I wanted my book to read. I mean, I worked with a developmental editor who said, you got to turn up the emotion here, or you got to give Darby a real reason that she has to make a decision, either staying back in the past or going back to the future, so to speak. You can't just have it be all chill, because that, your plot needs to work. But I think I achieved, and I hope I achieved for anybody who gets it, what I wrote about, that there's a lot of that kind of hangout feel. and you are experiencing the story with the characters versus, you know, being in the upper rafters of an auditorium, not really participating. There's something participatory about music and movies and TV and art and culture in the 90s that is separate from streaming and social media. Mm-hmm. It's the way that we are sort of invited to participate in the lives of, you know, the characters in the art of the 90s, I think is kind of unique. And I think only, you know, revealing the tip of the iceberg on that, but it's something that I think a lot of us pick up on.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I really appreciate that description of the hangout, spending a full day with characters. And while other people may feel like it's not, you're not doing anything, that you're really getting that experience of what it is to hang out with these characters that you relate to or appreciate what they're going through or how they're navigating life.
Yeah, I've never owned a gun. I don't want to, but I mean, I felt like in the scene with Jules and Vincent in Pulp Fiction, where they go to get the suitcase back from, you know, the kids, that,
yeah,
I'm in the midst of that scene. I'm in the car when they shoot Marvin in the face accidentally. It's not because I'm into gruesome stuff. I mean, there's been times mm-hmm. where I shut my eyes during one of Tarantino's other movies, Inglourious Basterds, because I didn't really want to see somebody hit in the head with a baseball bat. But, you know, in Pulp Fiction, it's like, especially with the talk about things that we're all, like, we talk about pop culture, they talk about what a TV pilot is, they talk about fast food. Like that, I don't know if that happened in cinema in the 60s and 70s. It was, pop culture is sort of, I don't know, it's obviously changed America and changed Western culture, and it's more than just a thing that we do on the side. So
yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Well, I've really appreciated you sharing all these pieces about your creative process and experience of character and interviews. I just have one last question.
Yeah.
What does it feel like in your body to be creative?
You know, I'm a little type A and high strung, and I tend to, it's weird, because when I first started writing consistently, I wrote at night, I would have a glass of wine. I don't do that anymore. Now it's during the day and it's coffee. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's an activating, primarily in a good way. Like mm-hmm. I have a sense of urgency about it, which I don't know if it's healthy or not, but it's productive. And not in an anxious way. I guess I feel like I'm just sort of, I'm activated and I'm participating in something, and it feels motivating. And I think obviously different people have different personalities and write different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that's a little bit more, I guess, in second or third gear for me than maybe most writers are.
Okay. I appreciate that. Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. If people want to learn more about the things that you do, where can they find your book? How could they go about doing that?
Yeah, you go to 90daysinthe90s.com. That's with the numbers. Or my website is andyfrye.com, and that's F-R-Y-E, so there's E at the end. Both places will have, you know, something about the book. You can buy it direct from me, and I'll sign it and send you some swag, too, if you're in the United States. Otherwise, if you're on Amazon, which, you know, a lot of people are all the time, it's there. You can find it on Amazon. Or I always tell people, like, if you got a favorite little bookstore, independent bookstores, like, they may have to order it, but if you are the mindset that I am, that you want to throw them business and, you know, help them thrive, that, you know, you can definitely, you can order my book that way and give the business to the local bookshop. And I've actually got a couple record stores in Chicago that have a copy of my book too, if it's still there. But yeah, online or local bookstore, I would say, is probably the best way. Otherwise, I'm on social media, on Insta and Twitter at Sporty Fry. That's Fry with me. And I mostly just rant about sports and pop culture and, you know, 90s stuff all the time.
Nice. Well, thank you again. It's been a pure pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the Sustaining Creativity Podcast. We'd love to keep in touch, so follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We are at Sustaining Creativity. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Tag your friends and family so they can listen too. We love to hear from you, so leave your reviews, comments, and questions. Check out our website, sustainingcreativity.com, for upcoming offerings and creativity coaching. Tune in Tuesdays for our next episode. And remember, with creativity, anything's possible.